when Jonathan Gold was alive and that restaurant opened, he did this amazing quote that said, you know, he had eaten at the original Hatfields like half a dozen or a dozen times. And it wasn't until he stepped into that new location and he listed, you know, how it had been scrubbed to this glory and talked about the room. He said it wasn't until he stepped in that location that he realized how well they cooked.
Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host, Lucas Rivodio, sincerely considering a late-in-the-game career change because today's guest opened my eyes to a whole new way of seeing the world of restaurants. We're joined today by Alexis Redinger, the founder of Preen Inc., an international award-winning hospitality architecture and design firm based right here in our City of Angels. Alexis walks us through her fascinating career designing some of Los Angeles's most iconic dining rooms, from Michelin star establishments to beloved hot chicken powerhouse Hal and Ray's. More than that, though, Alexis discusses all that goes into the design process. And sure, there's talk of logistics and timelines, but there's also reflections on getting to the heart of what a restaurant is trying to convey and how you bring a feeling or a vibe to life in a physical space. We talk about design trends over the years, which design trends Los Angeles is recognized for around the world, and what the heck an architect does when a client won't stop asking for a punny neon sign. To say I learned a lot is an understatement. I truly don't think I'll ever walk into a restaurant without paying attention to certain details ever again, and I'm excited to hear what you think, dear listener. Quick housekeeping note, the LA Food Podcast is now available on YouTube. So if you're tired of just listening to our beautiful voices and want to take our relationship to that next visually intimate level, dear listener, go ahead and visit us at youtube.com/@theLA Countdown and hit that subscribe button. I'll drop the link in the show notes too. That's enough of an intro for today. So without further ado, let's chow down. Joining us today on the LA Food Pod is the founder of Preen Inc., an architecture and design studio that specializes in hospitality design. It's Alexis Redinger. Alexis, how are you doing today?
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Luca.
Thanks for making the time. I can only imagine you're a very, very busy person. Where are you calling us from today, Alexis?
Actually, from Chinatown in LA, from the historic core.
The historic core. That's awesome. Are those your LA stomping grounds?
Yeah. Our studio is down here. I live down here. And it's all, you know, sort of that range from Atwater, Silver Lake, you know, downtown LA.
So when you need to like DoorDash some good food, what are your go-tos, your local standbys?
Well, DoorDash or go out?
Either one. You know, if you're more like just go out and grab the food, that's fine too. I just know me. Sometimes people with busy schedules, all they have time for is the DoorDash.
Well, I have to say that I just postmated Little Fatty and didn't realize it was coming all the way from Culver City, but it was extraordinary and totally worth it. You know, my favorite little out spots around here, Tsubaki, super good. Elf, that's a really good one. Maybe the Tam O'Shanter and Dunsmore.
I love Dunsmore. That is truly like such a treat every time I'm able to go. I live really close to there, but I don't get there half as much as I should. Have you been to Queen Street up the street from there yet?
No. Should I try it? I'm gonna write it down.
Absolutely. If you like that sort of like Southern influenced cooking, Queen Street is the other restaurant of the people from Found Oyster, and they do like Charlestonian food. So it's pretty interesting. So you might be into it.
Oh, got it. Is it over in the Industry Partners development where Barrio Santos is?
No. So that would be Cypress Park, right? This is actually closer to the border between Eagle Rock and Highland Park on York. It's also a new development there too. And Queen Street was the first thing to open. I think there's going to be a bunch of other stuff to open in that development, but it's like super new, super sleek, super chic. Yet the Queen Street space feels very like almost like lived in. I don't really know how you actually managed to achieve that. You probably know how to achieve that, but we'll get into that in a little bit. Look, speaking of Southern food, though, my understanding is that you actually are not from Los Angeles. You are from the great state of Texas. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah, and I left home state off the list. That's a regular stomp.
Is home state an accurate representation of Texas tacos?
Austin breakfast tacos, but she makes really good queso.
Yeah, I agree. That's good stuff. Although I've never had the original in Texas. What was Alexis like as a kid? Were you into food? Did you enjoy eating things?
You know, it's funny how life spirals because I didn't think about it until, you know, I was much like more adult, you know, that we used to dine. My family was very food centric and my parents were totally good taking us to like course dinners, you know, sort of silver service. My mom used to take me actually around town with her and visit, and we would go by the patisserie and say hello to the pastry chef that she was friends with. And I kind of remember like every restaurant. I mean, I don't know if I remember all of them because if I've forgotten, I wouldn't know it. Yeah. But I have extensive memory of various restaurant experiences.
What sticks out to you about them? Is it the food or is it more like the feeling of being there and the ambiance?
I mean, it's both, but definitely the spatial experience, you know, the energy of the space and how one interacted with it and what you did, you know?
Yeah. So it sounds like you caught this quote unquote architecture bug, which is a phrase I've never said before, but you caught it at a pretty young age then, it sounds like.
Yeah, I didn't really know it. In fact, I was sort of on a track to be an attorney. And then randomly started taking some art classes and started creating pretty large, like 20 foot high inhabitable shells of different experiences. And I had a professor recommend to me that I look at architecture school. Yeah, I thought it would be a good way to like, because I was really naively making art without any particular intelligence to it. It's just making. And I thought this is a way to put the sort of critical theory and analysis I'm doing with the art and create something really great. Thinking I would stay in the art world, but that's not what happened.
At what point were you like, screw the law, I'm not into this at all?
Yeah, about that time. Yeah, in college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I applied to architecture schools. I was a baby. I finished college the day I turned 21 and then came right out to LA to grad school at UCLA.
What were your first impressions of LA back then?
You know what? I loved it. I still love it. There's a certain vitality and a hum and an energy that the city has. When I first got here, I didn't know anyone and I would just drive everywhere. I think when I moved out here, I wasn't used to the density. And so I used to drive to the ocean too, just to have the feeling of space, like you get in the prairie in Texas.
What were your, when you got to Los Angeles, I feel like when I got to Los Angeles, there were certain foods that I was like, I have to like really dive into these. I have to go to like In-N-Out. I got to try chili cheese fries. I had this like, you know, need to go to Pink's Hot Dogs for some reason based on the pop culture. Were there any of those like staples you really wanted to hit up or like were really interested in visiting or that you were taken with when you came out here?
You know, when I got out here, like I really didn't know anyone at all. And I had 3 months before grad school started. And I was getting kind of lonely. I used to just listen to talk radio just to have some sort of human voice. And so I was living in Westwood. I went and I had always been curious about what it would be like to work in a restaurant. And so I went and applied and became a host at a Mexican restaurant in Westwood. So kind of in that world, I wasn't out being social or seeking food. I was just sort of operating in that realm.
What was the restaurant?
It was called Carumba.
That's amazing. I'm assuming Carumba is no longer with us.
Yes, yes. Actually, it's one of those beautiful old Westwood buildings on the interior where it's sort of coffered ceilings and gorgeous. Mm. I definitely wasn't savvy to the conversation of like food and brand. I mean, there were amazing, we were having, you know, my dad would come in town, we'd have some amazing dining experience. It was the sort of era of the birth of lingerie and patina and that mm-hmm. whole world. But just on a day-to-day like that, the really playful QSR, quick service restaurant, that's, you know, amazing, helmed by a great chef and is casual and it's really charmingly tied to brand, like that didn't, I don't think that really existed yet.
Hmm. In grad school, when you were studying architecture, did you have any idea of the type of architecture you'd want to eventually go into?
No, not really. I was very interested in visual relationships and how to disrupt space in an interesting way. Like one project I remember working on was an opera house, and I actually divided and created two audiences. And then there was this really interesting piece in between. So, but basically each audience would see a different version of the performance, and it would kind of push creativity, because then the person writing it, staging it, like all of that could then needed additional thinking.
That's cool. It's almost like designing something for theater in the round as opposed to just like a regular theater, but an interesting new spin on that.
Yeah, totally. And it's something we think about in restaurants now too, you know? There's like the rise of mediation around food and attention to the kitchen is totally different than it was like, let's say in the 80s. So mm-hmm. it's like a lot of the models that we've seen over the last 20 years have a disruptive relationship to an old school model restaurant. And they're very much about the energy intensity and the fire of the food and how do you connect to it in different ways.
What drew you to the world of restaurants and hospitality in terms of design?
You know, it was an accident.
A happy accident, I hope.
Yeah, for sure. I was working in a very proper pedigreed architecture firm. And a friend of mine kept encouraging me to come work with them. And I didn't really want to leave the world of doing ground up architecture, which I didn't realize I didn't have to leave exactly. But I ended up joining them. They offered me a considerably large pay bump over where I was. And it was this amazing, fun office of, you know, like six people doing the hottest restaurants in LA in the 90s. At the end of the 90s. Yeah. And I loved it.
Did you have any reservations about, you know, kind of, for lack of a better term, pigeonholing yourself in design, like hospitality spaces?
Yeah. You know what? I always have. I don't anymore. And the reason for that is there's an element of what we do in designing restaurants that I call them our joy spaces, right? Mm-hmm. They're about expression for the chef, for their art, expression for people to experience their lives. But I also have a personal project. And I think as I get older in the second part of my career, there's going to be a little bit more, I would say, in the deep, deep, deep wellness sector, which is I have a project that's for end of life. A beautiful, earthy architectural compound where one goes to for the last 10 days of life. And the reason why my partner is an end-of-life doula, the reason why we look at it the way we do is because in so many ways, we're coming from the world of hospitality.
Mm.
So there's a generosity and a bridge and an idea of life purpose and of being in service that is super important. So I think once I started to understand that that energy extends out in a mm-hmm. lot of ways, then I could really say, you know what? We do amazing restaurants and, you know, in my design firm and have it all make sense.
That's really cool. And I totally see the parallels there. And I imagine that that extends to so many different, you know, fields of life and fields of design. For people who are listening to this, and I would say that this is probably most of our listeners, they have absolutely no idea, myself included, about what goes into restaurant design, architecture, literally what falls under your scope of responsibilities, even, I think. Could you give us a quick walkthrough of, like, sort of soup to nuts, what a project looks like for you when you take one on?
Yeah, totally. And if there's anyone that's restaurant curious about owning one or starting one, I'm like, get very informed. Please feel free to call me. There's a lot that goes into it. So there's the world of concept and creative, right? So, and restaurants are these sort of three-legged beasts of food, service, and vibe, basically. Mm-hmm. So our highest value is really in that creative space. And, you know, if we're working with a chef, for example, and it's a flagship or signature for them, we're really thinking about the way they're cooking, the nuance of it. And then really trying to capture that energy and that zeitgeist in the space, in the ethos of it. So people are like fully in the experience of mm-hmm. that gift that chef wants to give another person. If it's a smaller sort of like a Hallen Raise, like mm-hmm. we've done with the Hallens, that one's really talking about the brand and the experience too. So the design ends up becoming almost an inhabitable brand. That's the ethos mm-hmm. that's tied to the food. So there's the creative, and we work with, you know, graphic designers and all the other people that are in this world too with that. There's also the architectural. So the architect of record service, and this is all the nuts and bolts, and we do this too. So then it's like, once we have a schematic layout, we're talking to a kitchen designer. Sometimes we lay it out if it's tiny, but that's not our mm-hmm. expertise. We work with a kitchen designer. They lay it out. Then we need to take it to mechanical, electrical, plumbing engineers, structural engineering, depending on what's needed. And we're coordinating all of this and then getting that through the permitting process with the city for building and safety and the health department, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So how long does all that take?
Well, it depends how big the place is. Let's say a 5,000 square foot restaurant. That's like a sit down. It's going to take about, if you're really timely, 6 months of design, pre-construction, permitting, and 6 months of construction, and then a month of training and startup. But it wouldn't be uncommon for that to be 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they can just have unforeseen issues and take even longer. A smaller place is a little quicker.
Well, that all, you know, when you lay it out like that, it all makes sense conceptually. And I'm sure you make it sound way easier than it is probably. But I think, you know, for those of us who are less creatively inclined, it might help to hear some specific examples of projects you worked on. So out of curiosity, what was the first restaurant project you worked on?
The first restaurant project I worked on was a sushi restaurant in Ontario. And okay. I had just started my business. I had been laid off although I had already printed my own business cards. So I was definitely ready. And the firm I was in had a slowdown. So, but they didn't want to pay my full fees, which weren't very much at the time. And they just wanted this sort of consulting binder. And to this day, I would never do it like that again. But because even though they wouldn't pay for me to go out and do site checks and make sure everything was coming along, it was my first project. So I kind of just was doing it for free. Mm. And I had just started the business. So I had this like ancient classic Range Rover that if I was driving down the freeway would sometimes wrench to the left. It was super dangerous. And at the time, I think all my credit cards were pretty maxed out and I wasn't really sure if I'd have enough gas to get there. But I kept going to site all the way out in Ontario just to see. And but the people running the project were making changes without involving me that really didn't serve to keep the design consistent, including putting like fake mannequin bodies on the wall to show their bikinis that they had with the restaurant logo. I was like, there's like the underwear merch on the wall.
Yeah. You're like, that was not in my rendering.
That was not the vibe I thought we were going for.
Yeah. Not a vibe most sushi restaurants would go for, I would assume.
Right. It begs some conversation.
Maybe that could serve as inspiration for some future designs, you know, some real, real conversation starters. Put panties on the wall. In a project like that, what are some types of things you think about tangibly when you're trying to create the vibe? Like, are you getting a brief from the client that's like, oh, we want people to feel X, Y, Z when they're in here? And you're like, okay, here are the tools at my disposal to make that into a reality. Or are you like, hey, I've seen like your concept and whatnot, and here's the vibe I think we should try to curate in here?
Well, I'll answer it both ways. So number one, that's our job. Listening and trying to get that information out of people, you know, and we're dealing with all different kinds of personalities. It might be a money person or it might be, you know, but it's like, who is really the passion driver for the project? And really getting, I mean, nobody opens a restaurant because it's like the smartest business decision in the world. They're incredibly difficult business models. And right, there, somebody is doing it because there's some experience that they would be willing to incur a great amount of risk for someone else to have that experience. Or there's something they just are really committed to or care to share, usually. So that's what we're listening for. And they may or not be a person that's good with language. So a lot of the work we do in my office is discovery, and it's listening and honing those skills. And not everybody works like that. And you can see, if you look around and you see an inspired sort of restaurant interior that kind of looks like something you saw on Pinterest once, or, you know, there's a lot of mimetic aesthetic grabbing. You're like, oh, this subway tile's in, let's use it. Terrazzo's in, right, let's use it. And it may have nothing to do with the energy of the client and what they're actually, what they're doing, you know? So that's our job that way. Sometimes we don't have that person. And so it's really a listening for spirit of place. Or it's always, you know, paying attention to the demographic and the psychographic of the people that are local or that we think are coming too.
Yeah. Speaking of the mimetic quality, you know, how often do clients ask you to include some sort of like, you know, mimetic thing? Like, let's say, I don't know, a neon sign or something. And you have to be like, ugh, do I push back here or do I just give in?
Right. It's eras. Oh, it's the era of hanging plants and neon.
Yeah, exactly.
They will ask, but that's usually just a place. I mean, and also we want our people to be happy, right? So it's like being able to say, all right, they want, what is it about the neon do they want? Are they wanting some sort of messaging, which we don't like to do a lot of literal messaging in projects because it can feel heavy-handed to a patron? Or is it this sort of electric lighting and color that they like? What is it about the thing that they want? And what is the feel there? Because like red neon, it's interesting you mentioned neon. Neon is naturally red or white, like the gas. And if you have other colors, it's because they put a coating on the inside of the glass tube. So I'm kind of in love with the deep, there's like a deep purple that you see on sometimes, but it's really difficult to get somebody to make that color. And I don't know why exactly, but if it's a conversation about warmth and electricity, then it's, there's many ways to that. And so we might want to think about that too. And also yeah, if it's like, straight out like dated, we're going to be like, that's super dated.
Well, it's, I feel like it's like in any consulting work as well, like you kind of try to get to the bottom of your client's overarching goal. And if they have a tactical idea, you're kind of like, actually that idea isn't achieving the overarching goal you've set out to achieve, but let's see why, let's tease out why you like it and figure out a way to like make it work within the context of the vision, right?
Yeah. And not be attached to anything just because of our preference either.
Yeah.
And that's a conversation we have with clients sometimes. We're not designing something a certain way because it's what we like necessarily. We like it, but it could go any number of ways. It's really about what's going to create the vibe and the narrative and what feels really great. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about some of the marquee projects, or marquee, at least as you know, I see them, that are in your resume, if you will. One that that caught my eye is Hatfields. Would you walk us through sort of your role in Hatfields and sort of how that whole project played out?
Oh, I love it. Thank you for bringing up an old one. That was very beloved and known in LA, and was really came about right at the time that fine dining started having its swan song in Los Angeles. But in that one, Karen and Quinn, and it's actually, it's where Meteora is now, the building. If anyone's tried Jordan Kahn's.
It's on Melrose, but, right?
Karen and Quinn Hatfield had a version of it that was super little tiny spot, really extraordinary chefs. And they brought us on to redo the space where Meteora is. And I think so much of what we did there was really trying to like create a conversation in the design about the bounty of the land. It was definitely a fine dining experience, like upholstered, and you could see the kitchen. And but one of the big pieces in it was I needed something to create intimacy in the room. And so, and we needed lighting, and we weren't working with a huge budget on that one back then. And so I was like, we could create this huge honeycomb, like massive. I don't remember how many feet, 15 foot wide or 20 foot wide, like honeycomb that suggests honeycomb, but then it also maps out the chemical components of honey, like sucrose and raffinose. And yeah, it's kind of cool. The bids came back really high. Ended up finding a custom bike welder who created it for us.
Wow.
But interestingly, we were, you know, and I didn't think about it at the time. This is sort of before social media, so I didn't never really. And looking back, when Jonathan Gold was alive and that restaurant opened, he did this amazing quote that said, you know, he had eaten at the original Hatfields like half a dozen or a dozen times. And it wasn't until he stepped into that new location and he listed, you know, how it had been scrubbed to this glory and talked about the room. He said it wasn't until he stepped in that location that he realized how well they cooked.
Wow. That's really powerful. I mean, that must have been crazy to hear for you.
Yeah. Super cool. Such a kind man, too.
I mean, that's really cool and something that, you know, I don't often think about as someone who is very food focused when I go out and eat. But I can only imagine that there have been countless times where even subconsciously my dining experience has been enhanced just by the vibe that has been curated before I even got there, right? I'm trying to think of like moments, but it happens all the time, right? Where you're like, oh, I feel really good in this space. And then you're kind of like even more inclined to just be open to the experience that you're about to have, right?
Mm-hmm. 100%. And that's something that we intentionally do, you know? I would say, take care of the introverts first. So when we actually do a layout in a space, we're very much thinking about intimacies and dynamics and grouping. Have you been to Tess up on Sunset?
I have.
We did a little funny thing like that. So when we have people coming into a restaurant, we always think about the layout in terms of creating individual areas that are small enough that the people in that area kind of get united a bit, right? And there's like a diversity of experiences that you can have in one space, but that you also feel really like tucked in and held in the one you're in. Unless we're trying to create something different intentionally. But that one's, there's a couple things we did in that one that are sort of interesting. Like when you walk in, there's a single counter that's parallel to the bar, but off of it. We did that so that if you're a local and it's a Friday or Saturday night and the place is super busy, that you can come in, you and your friend, and grab something at that second counter. And then we also did like paired love seats with deuces, with two tops, so that two people, actually four people that didn't come together and don't know each other might get sat together. People can be like, oh, this is a little awkward. And then, hi, we're sitting next to y'all. but they end up kind of laughing about it. They generally, I have seen somebody move and request something different before, but they generally are okay with it. They sort of get banded together and then they become a team, you know, in relationship to the rest of the restaurant. And if you can get people comfortable in their own space and then a little bit comfortable with their neighbors, which is what happens in every classic French bistro, right? You're kind of jammed in. Then you get people that start are having fun and they start to flirt with the rest of the restaurant. Visually.
That's cool. I'm going to think about that completely differently from now on. I have off, like, for example, just last night I was at a fantastic dinner and you know, the table next to us felt like really close. You know what I mean? Like I had to like squeeze through to like get to sit down. And it was the first thing I thought of when I sat down, but then it kind of just like, you know, dissipated from my mind as the food came and as I had conversation for dinner. And I wonder if that's because the way the restaurant was designed, it was just like, hey, it's just close enough where it feels close, but it's actually like designed to make it feel like this restaurant is full. It's bubbly. It's like there's a good energy in here. Cause that's actually how I felt throughout the dinner. You know, that I felt like this restaurant is like popping, it's bustling, it's friendly, there's like, you know, people having fun and whatnot. It's like a contagious energy.
That's super cool. I never know in that situation where you're trying to squeeze between the two tops or whatever, do I face the strangers or show them my backside?
Oh, backside. Obviously backside.
Backside? Oh, okay.
I mean I don't know that. I don't know if that's like proper etiquette. I just think that that's what I naturally do. And I feel like that's what I would want someone to do for me.
Thank you for clearing that up. Can you say what restaurant you're in?
Yeah, it was at Matu, the steakhouse in Beverly Hills.
Oh, cool. Cool. I haven't
tried
it yet.
Have you gone there? Oh, it's fantastic. Truly great restaurant. And the space is like very, very simple. It's still warm, but somehow like, you know, still minimalistic, I'd say. It's not one of these big, gaudy steakhouses by any means, but that kind of fits with the vibe of what they're trying to convey as well. You know, they're like very like proud of their beef and how like straight from the farm to them it is. It's very like clean food, clean steakhouse. It's not like your typical like creamed spinach and whatnot. So I kind of feel like the aesthetic really matches the intention there. And I appreciate that, you know. I want to move on from high-end spaces, though, because I want to talk about designing not just spaces that are a little bit more, for lack of a better term, lowbrow, but also spaces that have a pre-existing history to them, which I know is something you've done most recently, I believe, at Dino's in, is it West Adams? What do we call that neighborhood, technically?
I don't know. It's the Greek area, right?
On Pico, right, sort of heading towards downtown. And Dino's beloved, you know, chicken and fries restaurant, and recently got a facelift, and you guys were behind that. How do you go about approaching a space like that?
And first off, I'd have to say that the project is helmed by four sisters, and their dad started the original. And I think they have six of them. There's also another portion of the family, like an uncle, that has one or more. I'm not sure. And for them, they really wanted to like honor their dad and create something that was like the ethos and the iconic to what they had been doing for so long. For people who don't know, they have this like proprietary spice blend that their dad created that they use. They'll do like a chicken, rotisserie chicken with this spice blend, and there's a sauce with it. And so you order the like most quintessential disc is you order fries and then you get the roast chicken and then they pour the sauce on it. So you end up with this sort of yummy, soggy fry situation. It's pretty good.
Now I'm hungry.
Yay. And so it's like really looking into it because the building was kind of just, you know, Spanish tile, tiny little walk up, nothing particular about it at all other than that it's small. And so really kind of working with them and capturing something that felt like had the nostalgia of the 70s when their dad started. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's been 61 years, maybe. And something that was simple and that could, you know, like In-N-Out, you know how simply they do their design?
Mm-hmm.
It's like an iPhone for a restaurant, you know?
That's
and
cool.
So really bringing their palette to something that's just exactly theirs.
Did you have reservations about like changing something? I don't know. I think people get so like comfortable in their ways, right? They're just like, when I go to Dino's, I'm expecting it to look a certain way, right? Do you ever worry like about changing something?
Yeah. And they have a really interesting community that supports them. I mean, they're deeply loved by some superstar chefs. You know, seen a lot of press around that. They also, you know, my client would come in and say, yeah, well, the taggers were there this morning at 4. I caught them on camera, but then they came back at 7 to order breakfast. So they're really awesome people. They do a lot of feeding of the homeless and the kind of community around them. But I just felt like the way they are with their community is so strong that it was an opportunity for them to involve people in their transformation.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, people are really insistent about getting their chicken.
At the end of the day, there's chicken. Like,
it's dangerous. Don't get in the way of people getting their chicken.
Yeah, totally. As long as your design still let people get chicken, I think we're fine. Speaking of chicken, I want to talk about another project you've done recently, and it's one you alluded to, and that's Hal and Ray's in Pasadena. I think you did the other location as well. But this one strikes me as interesting, and you mentioned this earlier as well, where you're like, it was a brand-centric project, right? And when I was thinking about Hal and Ray's, you know, my mind goes to, for better or worse, like Dave's Hot Chicken, which is now expanding all over the world. And, you know, Hal and Ray's is so good that I expect it to keep expanding, not that I have any inside knowledge or anything. So how do you go into planning for something with a potential long-term vision? And I'm not saying like that's what's happening at Hal and Ray's, but for example, let's say the designer of the first and second In-N-Out locations, you know, how do you think about like imbuing a brand into a space that's recognizable, but not, you know, off-putting and that can be easily replicated?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think it's important to kind of just go back to the original one in Chinatown just for a second, because Johnny and Amanda were coming off the food truck and wanting to build this space out with really limited budget. One of the first things that we started to look at, right? Like, there's an authenticity issue right off the bat, because the original recipe is coming from Prince's in Nashville, right? And here's this white guy with a fine culinary background opening that in Chinatown. It's very LA, the whole hybridization of it. So we knew there were certain things, like palette wise, that were going to be like how we could build what we were doing with the space. And we didn't have a lot of money for it either. So we knew, like, you know, particle board and plywood and corrugated metal. And, you know, when we did the original, we wanted it to feel really warm and energetic. But we also wanted it to feel clean. And so it's like, what could we afford? White laminate countertops, not super fancy. And in order to keep it from being sterile, we have a lighting designer that we love dearly and is our creative partner. We did 2200 Kelvin lighting running above it, which is much, much warmer than normal lighting. And so from the outside, the whole place just diffuses fried chicken. So then when we wanted to come into Pasadena, now they're looking at this kind of lovely, a little bit Mediterranean style building that's just been kitted out in it. They have the signage from the old dairy farm. I forget the exact name of it, but where it lights up and you can just see the HR.
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's really cool. Pasadena's a little bit, I would say in some ways it's a kind of mature community. There's certain aspects of being traditional that it has. I think some of that's changing, but it's like when we were looking at that property, we were like, how do we play with this sort of nostalgia that we're getting from this dairy sign and this like a little bit of small town aspect that Pasadena has. And so we went with the really vintage wooden booths that are sort of curved and filled with ingrain maple. And the swooping counter is sort of reminiscent of an old school lunch counter, you know? And then we thought, okay, if we're getting a little bit more mature in some ways with these things, then how can we get a little bit more perverse at the same time and let it be the brand that Helen is? Because Helen's irreverent in a really great way. And so we've got, you know, the birds being projected down, or it's actually Ray is the bird, being projected down on the bar. And there's these moments of hot red and electric in the space.
Yeah. That's cool. I love your characterization of Pasadena as mature. It's so apropos because that's where I play pickleball, and there is no more mature sport than pickleball. So you nailed that one on the head. Now, these projects we're talking about, just Hatfields and to Howland Race, which opened last year, but in Pasadena, these projects span decades, and it sounds like your experience goes even further back than Hatfields. And obviously, as you mentioned, and as you've alluded to, there's been a lot of changes in those times. That's fascinating to me, sort of like how restaurant design evolves over the years. What are some of the biggest sort of like evolutions you've seen?
Trends that have happened over the years?
Yeah, or sort of like how things have changed. Like I feel like, I don't know, like the one that most comes to mind is like white tablecloths used to signify like, you know, literally white tablecloth dining, right? But now if you go to a white tablecloth dining at a 3 Michelin star restaurant, you're probably like, what the hell am I paying for? This feels like my grandmother's house, right? So like, not just trends, but sort of like what the sort of like thinking and sort of philosophy of it has evolved into.
I love it. And we keep having the white tablecloth conversation, and we're doing like a very cool, I can't talk about it yet, but cool, amazing chef, little spot in Beverly Hills. And we really did want the white tablecloths. And we ended up going with just the wood tops because I think no one wants to pay the laundry fees on them.
That makes sense.
It's just like extra burden on the project. And I think we're doing the new Odium in the Waldorf in Las Vegas. I think that conversation came up once, but it comes up as a question, you know.
Uh-huh.
That one's not very Tim, though. So how has it changed? You know, I think the biggest change I would say would be related to the issue of media attention on chef and adjacency to food. That's the biggest sea change that I saw sweep through. So it's like really disrupting layouts so that, you know, you have all these chef's counters and moments where you're, you know, the chef's table in the kitchen kind of, which may have always been there to some degree, but it just got exacerbated because people wanted to be near the action.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of our way of being in this space. I think, where are we in that? It's not as important as it was like 5 years ago.
The moment of like walking in and seeing like the kitchen and being able to like be kind of, for lack of a better term, in the action, that's not as pronounced as it was.
Yeah, there was a moment where we were creating like, because no one had really done it yet. Like, here, let's put them right up next to the hood and they can see everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Maybe it happened in like New York just because places are tiny and that's what they had, but it wasn't intentionally really being done. And then there was this period where that was. But I do think, and you know, we try to kind of, we it's not like we can resist trends. Like, I'm glad we're sort of tapering off everyone asking for plants everywhere. But, you know, because what it's really signifying is people are desiring a connection with nature.
Mm-hmm.
Or feeling there's sort of air and they can breathe, or there's nourishment of that kind, you know.
Yeah.
So like the underlying thing of the trend is important to pay attention to.
We've read a lot and we've talked a lot on the podcast about restaurants closing. It seems like last year, you know, every week there were stories of different restaurants closing. There's obviously a lot of factors at play, like increasing minimum wage, inflation, supply chain factors, all of it, right? How does that change, sort of like the tighter margins, factor in to what you do?
Oh, you know, I'm glad that the interest rates are theoretically about to go back down so that all the markets can move again, because I don't know what was up last fall, but we were getting calls and people are like, we've got 150,000. And I'm like, okay, 1999 called and it wants its budget that wasn't very good back then back. It's right there, you know, but we're building businesses and they mm-hmm. need to work. So there's no vanity or to that, but there's an entry fee. You know, you can get a chair for this much, or you can get a chair for this much. If you want to not spend much money, do a concept that's kind of related to a picnic or some sort of playful, light concept, like La Cita, for example, we did. Their concept was very conducive to being conservative fiscally.
Right.
And we could do a lot of color immersion and things that work. But you can't do like super posh, you know. I want it to feel like an English manor with not much money.
Yeah. It's like if you want to save the money, you got to have the right vision to be able to save the money.
Yeah, you got to have something that you can kind of like, oh, yeah, a park bench will be great.
I was going to say, I think your idea of the picnic concept could really take off during these economic conditions. So I don't know if anybody's listening. It doesn't sound like it's been done either.
Hey, well, actually, there was. I think Orrin Greenberg had a concept called Picnic, although it's probably gone now.
I was going to say, you know, we've talked about a lot of epic Los Angeles restaurants, and we've seen Los Angeles be a trendsetter in so many ways, like in the worlds of fashion, in the worlds of obviously entertainment, also in food. Definitely people view us as one of the biggest and greatest food cities in the world. Now, how does our influence on design, specifically in hospitality places, show up around the world?
Oh, I love it. I have to say first, LA is so awesome for people's exploration of their ancestry. And then when they're artistic, like their kinds of fusions and things that they create, it's that's what's always put, that is what put LA on the map. And as a culture, we're so loving and excited about our multiculturalism. And that's one of the things I love most about the city.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, our brand, like as our brand is L, as the city that gets exported. And I noticed something around 2013 in LA that shifted some of the thing. You know, I've long looked at the sort of design trends that occur in restaurants here and sort of thought about what's happening globally economically that are causing these things. You know, why are there Buddha bars all over? What is China doing? Why are we getting these Buddhas and these reproductions? You know, what sort of event is occurring that's creating it? And I've always thought about it from economic supply, because as designers, we're looking for things we can get a lot of for not much money for a restaurant, you know, something to help the bottom line of that kind of build. And so I always looked at it as economic event, global event impacting small scale. But right around 2013, something shifted, which is social media. And the way that I can see that that reshaped design trajectory in our city, I would say a good example would be if you look at like Kismet when that opened, right? This sort of very bleached out Nordic wood, sort of minimal plants, this sort of, you know, lifestyle aesthetic got really, really popular. And what ended up happening and what was desired and mediated globally was the quality of the light that we have in Los Angeles, you know, and that sort of minimal, bright aesthetic. And shortly after this, there was that kind of aesthetic was sweeping through Pinterest and Instagram. And shortly thereafter, we started having problems in California because the hillsides were being deforested of small succulents that were being sold abroad. So that's you start nuts. To see design aesthetic then have the impact back on that economy. It's kind of wild.
That is wild. I mean, it is truly wild. It reminds me of like, yeah, everybody sees the pictures on Instagram of people posing with those like orange flowers in Antelope Valley. So we all go to the Antelope Valley and like kill the flowers, basically, you know?
The poppy fields.
Yeah, the poppy fields. Exactly. Yeah, the poppy fields. Yeah. It's exactly that. Actually, funny story. One, when I saw that on Instagram for the first time, I was like to my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, I was like, yo, let's go to these poppy fields. And we went and they were all dead by the time we got there because everybody had done the same thing and then trampled all over them. So, you know,
it's just the
externality of living in today's modern social media age. Now, wanted to ask you about where you're at today and what you're working on today. What projects are you working on?
Yeah, we're working on a bunch. I mentioned Odium with Tim Hollingsworth. We did not do the original. We're working on the evolution, and that's in the Waldorf. And it's going to be an amazing restaurant. What are we working on? We've got a super interesting supper club that we're going to be popping into on Fairfax.
Oh, cool.
Chef isn't known yet exactly, but it's going to be a great chef. We've got another project that's like renovating a historic building in Bishop, California, adding sort of a James Beard level cafe, mercantile, community center, and so forth. So it's really interesting hybrid.
That reminds me of like, you know, Bells in Los Alamos, where it's like just this random little town, but it has this incredible culinary export. Be that kind of vibe?
Yeah, you know, I've been dying to go up to Bells. So I haven't actually been in the space, although I have spoken with them and they're darling. And now you remind me I need to go up there and try it. But maybe, yes.
Yes. Yeah. That's cool. That sounds like a really cool one.
Yeah. Oh, and I think we've just got a wine shop, if anyone's into the European wines, opening in Brentwood in the next couple of months for Thatcher Baker Briggs.
I think there will be plenty of people who are interested in wine who are listening to this. So mark your calendars, folks. Okay, well, that's awesome. And one question that I'm going to spring on you, actually. What is a dream project of yours? What is something you would love to work on one day?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, we definitely want to do a restaurant that's at the 3 Michelin star level. For sure. Very interested in that, like that high performance of a project. And then on the other side are some of the like beautiful earthy things that humankind needs that don't really exist yet. So we have an idea about a different way to artificially create a hot springs that could alleviate some of the natural sites. I mentioned the project that's for end of life. That's something we're starting to get ready to fund. And and then projects that have to do with therapeutics and psychedelics. You know, what are the places that humankind can go to have a connection to the infinite? You know, that's
cool. As opposed to like, you know, your friend's basement.
Right. I mean, nature is really the best for that, but we can't always be out in nature.
Yeah, true. The elements are real. The elements are real. Okay, Alexis, one final question for you. As you look back on your career, and you've had plenty of milestones, plenty of things to be proud of, but what are you most proud of?
Like, not a specific project, but I think in creating a culture and the culture of my internal team, you know, and really giving people a place where they can take on what they want to develop in themselves for their life and be of service and be responsible, but like go through that maturation process themselves and also learn to be in service to all of our clients there too. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing I'm the most proud of.
That's powerful. Well, Alexis, if folks are looking for you or for your work, where are the best places online to find you?
Oh, cool. So our website is preeninc.com, and that's like, you know, like a bird conditions their feathers. So P-R-E-E-N as in Nancy, I-N-C.com. And that's also our Instagram handle. So that's a good place too.
Easy to remember, and I will post it in the show notes. Alexis, thank you so much for making time for us. This has been an absolute delight of a conversation. I've learned so much, and I will absolutely be looking around everywhere when I go out to my next dinner.
Oh, thank you, Luca. I really appreciate it. You're super awesome.
How great was Alexis, dear listener? I mean, I'm not just saying that because she said I was awesome. Truly, that must be one of my favorite episodes we've ever recorded. Well, thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast, dear listener. And thanks to our guest, Alexis Redinger, for making the time to speak with us. If you like what you heard today, dear listener, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, all that stuff really helps our podcast make our way up the charts, both on Spotify and on Apple. We'll be back next week with another epic episode, but if you're looking for me in the meantime, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at the LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountdown. You can also find me on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOODPOD. And now you can also find us on YouTube at youtube.com/@TheLaCountdown.